The season of free is in full swing at T-Mobile. And this time, we're going big, like the biggest screen you'll ever see at T-Mobile big. Because we're giving away 50-inch Samsung 4K TVs. You heard right, a free 50-inch TV delivered in time for the holidays when you get one of the latest Samsung phones in Adeline. So get to a T-Mobile store right now, because this deal won't last long.
At participating stores, offer fulfilled by Samsung with online redemption code. Qualifying credit, new line of service, timely redemption, and phone finance agreement required. Two new lines required for new customers. One offer per account.
Mainstream Mental Health Radio
with Dr. John Huber.
What do you think you are, crazy or something? Well, you're not.
We're on a mission from God.
News, issues revolving around mental health.
Dr. John Huber, a mental health professional for over 20 years, the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, a clinical forensic psychologist, and a psychology professor at Texas State University. Breaking the silence of mental health one day at a time, discussing the human condition, providing a sounding board for mental health issues, and making mental health mainstream.
You got a gift, my friend.
Now it's time for Mainstream Mental Health Radio.
Let the healing begin.
With Dr. John Huber.
Welcome to Mainstream Mental Health Radio. This is your host, Dr. John Huber. I want to remind everybody to listen to us on Blog Talk Radio, Mainstream Mental Health. You can also follow us on our YouTube channel at Mainstream Mental Health. And today we have an amazing show for you. We have two great guests. And with all the activity that's happened the last few weeks here in the United States and Central Texas, it's going to be kind of a different twist on some of the stories, different angle. And I'd like to encourage you all to share our show with your friends. And remember, you can find out all about us at mainstreammentalhealth.org. All right. So this week in the news, we've had a lot of excitement, a lot of things that are not so good. But one of the things happened, we had a shooting at Sutherland Springs, Texas. And when we start looking at those events, we have to pay attention to the frequency of these types of events. Unfortunately, we had two back-to-back, Mandalay Bay, and then just a few weeks later, we're here in Sutherland Springs. And we have to start looking, why is this commonplace, or is it actually commonplace? If we look statistically, it's not very common in this country. And when we start looking, though, about how the media handles it, how society deals with things, I think we are getting a little numb to it. Our recovery time is much faster for the general population, but not necessarily for the victims themselves. If we look at what we know so far about Sutherland Springs, we know investigators on Monday scoured the background of the lone gunman who opened fire on the pews at the First Baptist Church there, and looking for answers on what kind of motives were there. We know his in-laws were basically members of the church. They were not in attendance, but his grandmother-in-law was in attendance, and she was one of the victims. In addition, there were 26 people were killed during that rampage, and in one family, we had 8 victims who died with 3 generations in just one single family, and it's pretty disturbing in general. We know as the week has progressed, in fact, just this morning, the church has come out and said that they're going to bulldoze the building and rebuild and build a new sanctuary. And at this point, if you're interested, you can look up First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, and there's lots of website links, and you can donate if you would like. They estimate it's going to take $2.5 million to rebuild. Then we have to start looking at Christmas music. It's that time of year. And for some reason this year, I've actually enjoyed listening to some of the Christmas music, and I usually don't. It usually infuriates me this early, and I don't want to hear it until Thanksgiving. And to the chagrin of my children who are sick of it already, but they'll get over it. But a new study is out there saying that Christmas music can harm your mental health. Are you one of those people who can't stand hearing Christmas songs months before holiday actually arrives? Does hearing festive carols weeks before Thanksgiving make you upset that you haven't eaten your turkey yet? A psychologist in Great Britain says your reactions don't make you a Grinch because too much Christmas music is actually bad for your mental health, he stated. Well, this psychologist, Linda Blair, claims the constant barrage of Christmas music and Christmas tunes too early in the season forces people to remember all the things they have to do before holiday. Blair says the songs are a reminder to buy presents, cater parties, organize travel, and all the more stressful chores during Christmas. So basically, he states, or she states, you're simply spending all your energy trying not to hear what you're hearing. The psychologist added that store workers are most at risk for being worn down by the catchy beats, and she states that hearing the same songs over and over each day make workers struggle to tune it out, and they become unable to focus on anything else. Now, Christmas songs are supposed to be festive and happy and upbeat, and I think some of these issues that she's talked about, the catering and scheduling and everything, if you started earlier on this and were more organized, you probably wouldn't have those types of stress reactions in the first place. So I think with every leaf you have, there's two sides to it, and some people may actually benefit from starting earlier. However, again, typically I am not that person. I know when my children were younger, my son in particular, whenever he would get happy, he would start singing Jingle Bells. It didn't matter if it was June or if it was December. And it was always funny to see him leading a group of little 3 or 4 year olds around the park in the middle of July singing Jingle Bells. So it does bring back some happy memories for me. And I truly do respond positively to a lot of that. However, it may be a little early to start. I'd really like to wait until Thanksgiving most years, but I think this year with all the tragedy we've had with Harvey, with Irma, with Mandalay Bay, and now with Sutherland Springs, trying to put a little joy in our life a little earlier may not be a bad idea. This is a reminder you're listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio. I am your host, Dr. John Huber. And today we have an interesting guest. Most of you listen know I do martial arts and I'm an avid hunter. And with all the recent shootings and things out there going on in this country, there is a lot of question about our Second Amendment rights. But I think that there's actually a lot of advantages to weapons training, not just martial arts, but using firearms and today I've got a special guest, Mr. Charles Heller, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about that. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, I know with martial arts there's lots of advantages for, you know, being able to focus and clear your mind and like that. Is there a comparable advantage for using firearms in hunting and shooting?
Well, I've been a certified instructor since 1991, and I've trained a lot of people. And there is a discipline, especially if you practice shooting for marksmanship, it has a very Zen-like quality to it. And it's there's a discipline you have to engage in if you're going to talk about marksmanship from a pure standpoint. For defensive training, what it has a tendency to do is markedly increase one's confidence, because they're more in control of their ability to respond if there is some criminal incident against them and it's very violent, and especially for women, it's a very empowering thing. I mean, you know, I don't think I'm qualified to talk about the towel or the gun, but I certainly see what happens in people when they're trained by somebody who's confident and who is concerned for the results, as I
yes.
am, and as a people like me. For instance, the good guy in that circumstance at the church in Texas who neutralized the attacker. fired and hit the bad guy twice, and it changed the bad guy's plans about any further attack. And at that point, he ran away, and then finished himself off towards the end of the chase. So, I mean, I see a difference in people's attitudes when they go on. Not that they swagger or that they're going to jump in front of something bad and try and fix it, but that they go more confidently about their way. And it's that, again, that's especially true for women.
Well, and, you know, you bring up women, and there's some historical things that I'm currently kind of working on for myself, and maybe a little paper that I might get to present at some time. Is there's a correlation, I think, to countries that allow civilians to own weapons and women's rights, where a woman can put herself on an equal basis with men. They tend to have more rights across the world, not just in the United States. So I think you're right about that confidence level.
Yeah, nothing's a better equalizer than a firearm. It's very non-sex. It's what's the word I'm thinking of? It's just an equalizer, I guess.
It is an equalizer. And go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, one of the organizations that I represent, which is Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, understands. We published a paper. We published many books about this. But one of the things that's almost universal in any case where a government has practiced democide is killing their own people. In every single case where there's been mass killings, be they starvations like Stalin did, whatever it happened to have been in the 20th century, the predicate act was always disarming of the populace. Or at least one of the predicate acts was always disarming of the populace. So it's a very empowering thing to have an armed citizenry. And there's relatively few countries that are completely open about it, like the U.S. is. Even Israel, which has a fairly well-armed populace, has fairly severe, not just strict, but severe gun control.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I didn't know that about Israel. But I did know that they are very well armed as a citizenry. One of the things that I see too, and practicing both, you know, sporting clays and hunting and martial arts, that I tend to get from all of them is, you know, this kind of euphoria that I know is directly related to a chemical reward system in your brain. Do you have any understanding or research on that my listeners might benefit from?
I don't because I really don't study that, and it's outside the area of my expertise. So I couldn't legitimately – it would be a boundary violation for me to comment on that. No worries.
I don't want you to do that. I know also for a lot of people who are frustrated – you know, going out and focusing, whether it be with firearms or any other thing, actually, can help you deal with your emotions and anger and frustration. But I think weapons, are, especially firearms, are uniquely qualified in helping people deal with anger and frustration. Now, I'm not talking about somebody who has a rage disorder or something like that, but just your average frustration with going through life but being able to go to the range and sit down and focus and isolate your mind and target that dot at the end of the 100 yards or 50 yards, whatever range you're shooting at, there's something inherently calming about that.
There is because – and I think part of it, at least I can speak from my personal experience, oops, an alarm just went off. Let me turn that off and I can – otherwise, it'll ride over. There we go. The ability to focus both the mind and the body on one thing kind of drives out for me other thoughts. I'll give you a working example. I have a range in my home. I have an air gun range inside my home in my hallway. And I have there's a company that there's several companies that makes pellet traps. So it's utterly safe to shoot inside the house. There's no one here I would endanger, and the dog is in another room. So I put on a pair of safety glasses, And I have this discipline that every night at 10 p.m., I go to this to my little 30-foot range and open the closet door that has the pellet trap hanging on it and take out, I have an air gun. It's a single-shot air gun. I have an air gun handgun, and then I have an air gun rifle. And I always shoot the handgun first and the rifle second. And there's just a piece of firing five shots, looking at the target. I use a paper target, and I mark the target with the day so I can track my progress with it. So it's not just random. It's not just random practice. It's very focused and organized practice. And I notice what it allows me to do when I practice with the air gun is it allows me to acquire the sight on my handgun when I, because I teach. I teach the concealed weapons class. And
right.
when the students come, in order to show them about best grip and best stance and best sight picture, I use their guns. I actually fire a couple rounds out of each student's gun myself. And what I've noticed my air gun practice does, it allows me to instantly focus on the sights, even though every gun is a little bit different, every brand of gun
right.
is a little bit different. It allows me to instantly find their sights because my eye just goes to that. And it's a discipline that's not only fun, it's become sort of a ritual. And I know that if I ever had to use it for real, which I hope I never do, that I know that the rounds would go exactly where I'm pointing them because that's where they always do go.
Well, and there's something about that muscle memory and the physical action of going through that procedure when you're not under stress, because when you are in stress, your brain blanks out. I mean, the emotional
right.
hormones that are released, the adrenaline, and you can't think straight, but your body takes over. And that's what it sounds like you're talking about, even with your
right.
normal training where you're teaching other students and you pick up their guns, you don't even think about it. Your brain automatically has this automaticity to it, and your body just takes over.
Mm-hmm. Well, we learn best what we teach, and so, and that's part of it. And the other thing is that if an instructor is teaching a subject, that instructor ought to be competent in the topic. And so, if you take their gun and put a couple rounds right where it's supposed to go, and say that's about where you should be hitting on the target, and it is exactly where it's supposed to go, not only does it say, "Wow, the guy knows what he's doing." But it also says, oh, it's doable. The message it quietly sends to the student is, oh, this thing is doable.
And that whole idea of confidence. Right.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's not arrogance. It's not to say, I am so good at this that I can't miss. It's none of that. It's you want to impart this both a knowledge and a skill at the same time. You want to impart the knowledge to the student that is doable and the skill to do what they know they can do, both the physical and the mental aspect of it, that it conveys something to the student that is a skill in their life.
Definitely. And, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, my students have always come with me in the university because they talk about all these professors who have this theoretical knowledge, but none of them have actually been out in the field working with whatever subject it is. Now, I know at our university, our business department is full of very successful businessmen who have kind of retired, but who also have, you know, the education to go with it and they're coming in. But in most other areas, whether it's sociology, social work, psychology, you know, have these people actually been doing that? And that's one of the compliments I get all the time because I actively practice and my students know that. My classes are much different than their other professors' classes who have never been out in the field and had to actually deal with, say, someone who is having their first active psychotic episode. So you practice what you preach. Not only do you practice it, but you live it. And I think that's
yeah.
very commendable. And I think students get much more from that than they ever will because anybody can read a book.
Right. Well, I say if you're going to listen to an instructor about firearms, make sure that his holster has some wear marks on it.
Exactly.
You don't want somebody that just talks about it and doesn't really do it. But, you know, I want to go a little further, if I may expand
okay.
a little bit here. It is a responsibility for a person who's going to carry the means of lethal force. it's a responsibility not only to know the laws, but to know their own mind as to what they're willing to do. Because if you go out with the mindset that, gee, I'm only going to wave a gun around and it'll stop somebody. And I got to tell you that the statistics show that in almost every one of these cases where the active shooter has encountered let me turn the alarm off. Just starting my day here, and sometimes I need an alarm to motivate me. The active killer, when they meet resistance, has always stopped. They've ended themselves. They finished the fight themselves by finishing themselves off. And if you think that you're simply going to wave the gun and make them stop, it's not true. Most of them have had to have been shot one or two times. That was true with Gene Assam at the First United Methodist Church in Arvada, Colorado. Mm-hmm. That was true with the incidents that happened last week. The bad guy had to absorb the bullets before it changed their mind. And if you're not 100% committed to doing that, if it's necessary to do it, you need to leave your gun in your safe and only take it out when you go to the range. But if you understand and you're mentally committed that if it happens, you're going to follow through and neutralize the threat, then it's a valid thing to do to carry the gun. And I also, the other half of it is that you got to carry it responsibly. You know, you can't have it in a holster that doesn't fit or doesn't work, or it's carried in a way that your gun looks like it might fall out of it, because it scares the, even if it doesn't fall out, if it looks like it's going to, it scares the hell out of people. And I get such a kick because we have open carry in Arizona. But I get such a kick out of other business people. I was talking to the president of the one of our chambers of commerce here, the Hispanic Chamber, the president and the vice president, and they were substituting on the radio in our radio studio. And his name is Edmund, and Edmund said to me, he looks at me and he goes, "I know you're carrying, but what is it?" And I told him what gun I had on, and he goes, "I feel safe." He says, "If anything goes wrong, I know I'm gonna go run towards you." And I said, that's a compliment, but what was really funny is he could not see. I mean, I carry a fairly decent size handgun and a spare magazine and a bunch of other stuff. I carry an ASP baton. I don't know if you've ever seen the batons, the expandable batons the police carry. Yes. I carry one of those too. And he couldn't see any of it on me.
Right.
You know, I that's a responsible carry. Or even if you're carrying openly, if it's secure in a secure holster that's not easy for somebody to grab, these are responsibilities that people who carry every day and are serious about it know, and they accept those responsibilities.
Well, and what I see also, there is this, you know, group of people in our country who are reacting emotionally to guns as if they're actually able to commit the assault. And they love to call everything an assault rifle. When assault is an action verb, you know, you have to be doing something. So a gun can never assault on its own. It takes a human to assault. And they react out of fear versus respect. And I think what you're doing is you're showing respect. You're teaching respect. And that's what I try to do with my kids.
Yeah. It's what any responsible teacher does. You know, Zig Ziglar, the motivational speaker, had a wonderful talk about fear. And he said it actually stands for something. It stands for false effects appearing real. That's what fear is.
Yes.
And what I find is people who confidently, again, not arrogantly, but confidently go about their business while armed, have a tendency, you know, fear is like a mist, and confidence is kind of like a fan. It just sort of disperses the mist, you know, and that's kind of how I look at people. They're little self-powered electric fans of confidence. They kind of gently blow away the fog and you know, bring some clarity to things. I find that clear thinking and being armed go very well together. It also increases the situational awareness. Because one of the things we teach in self-defense is about the color codes of awareness, where we call it conditioned yellow. It's a relaxed state of alertness. And conditioned yellow is a simple realization that something that looks bad or smells bad is bad. You know, you smell smoke. Well, conditioned yellow is that condition of the mind where you're willing to believe if you smell smoke that it might be the house you're in that's on fire. And not that you should run about in a panic, but that you should go and check, and you should also have the fire extinguisher ready. And that's what conditioned yellow is. And I notice, for me, that when I am armed, when I put the gun on in the morning, I've noticed that that puts me into conditioned yellow, that relaxed state of alertness. And I try to convey that to the students I teach. I teach a concealed weapons class once a month at the biggest gun shop in Tucson, and I've been doing that for many years. And we try and promote awareness and situational awareness, like pilots have about the things going on around them, that prevent people, that have a tendency to prevent people from getting into trouble. Or like you saw Sunday, a guy who was situationally aware heard gunshots and recognized them immediately as gunshots, not some car backfiring, and turned the TV up louder to cover it. So, you know, that's condition yellow.
And I totally respect and loved his response. I mean, he was in the moment, he reacted, he did what needed to be done. And then when it was over, you know, he didn't get up that morning going, I'm going to go kill somebody, you know, but as a result of his action, somebody died and he was distraught. He was like, I'm no hero. I did what any American should have done and he believes would have done. And
any Texan.
And Arizona, and I believe. I have lots of friends in Arizona.
Well, deference to Texas, that's where he was. I don't know that a New Yorker would have done that. I really do not know that.
You know, and I don't know either, and nobody really actually knows how they would react in a trauma situation like that. And that's why I really love you. You know, the last thing you do every night is you go through your firearms procedures. And, you know, it's just automatic. You don't have to think about it because our mind will take us a lot of different places. You know, I know when I was growing up and I was learning firearm safety and, you know, we kept hearing what they call buck fever, you know, that first deer you're going to fire and it's going to miss and you're not going to know why. And, you know, it's because you're so new at it and you haven't gone through that methodology and you haven't drilled and practiced enough. And you let your mind get control of your body.
The only thing I'm concerned about with using an air gun for training is that if I ever do use a firearm for real, that I may want to try and grab the barrel and break it open in the center to cock it. But I don't think I will.
I don't think you would. I don't think you would. But you know, maybe
like an air gun. So.
Well, you know, there's so much to this whole training model with weapons, not just firearms. And, you know, my whole family got into martial arts because my son was assaulted and had bruised neck by somebody in his school. He was hit from behind, and it put him into a state of trauma. And he basically, at that point, when he'd get to school every day, he would take his chair and put it up against the wall because this kid hit him from behind. And he sat with his back to that wall watching the other students just in case because it happened once and he wasn't going to let it happen again. So I got him into martial arts, and the difference that it made in his life was so profound. And my kids don't see it. My wife and I talk about it all the time with both my daughter and my son. But, you know, we talk about all this violence with guns. And, you know, I think it was 2014, there was something like 200 and some odd people were actually killed by a long rifle, not a pistol. Those numbers are much higher than that. But there were 687 people that were killed by somebody's hand.
Right.
And you're, you know, whether it's your hands or that rifle or that pistol, we have a responsibility to train in case you ever have to use those. I believe that because I have a constitutional right to defend myself. And I think
not only
you've got the right attitude.
Prepare. Yeah, not only train, but mentally prepare. You know, it's both physical and emotional. It is, you know, it is the willingness to do what's necessary. And I relate it to practical living. I mean, the reason you carry a spare tire in your car is in case you have a flat. But unless you're both willing to get down on your hands and knees and with a star wrench and loosen the lug nuts and change the tire, a spare tire does you zero good. I mean, and
exactly.
You know, and to go beyond that, I wear decent slacks to work. I don't want to ruin them by putting my knee on the ground. I have in my tire changing kit, I have a knee pad. So not only can I change the tire, but I won't ruin my clothes doing it. I have planned to do it. And I, from time to time, will use that if I need to get down on the ground to pick something up or do something else. I will, from time to time, pull out that knee pad, put it down, kneel there, pick up whatever it is or do whatever it is I need to do on the ground next to the car. So I've actually had the experience of practicing doing it. And I'm not excited about changing tires, but I do, and I keep a regular star wrench, not just the cheapy single handle lug wrench that they have. I actually have a star wrench that I went to an auto parts store and placed, and it's a lot easier with one of those to change to loosen the lug nuts than it is with the factory thing. So I have not only prepared for it, I have a tool for it, and I also have a little bit longer one that's a single wrench, but it's got more of a 90-degree angle, and I keep that up by the driver's seat.
Really?
Yep.
That to me, I think, would be more threatening than you carrying concealed handgun.
Well, it's harder to I don't carry that one concealed. Well, it's on the floor. There's a lip in between the seat and the floor, so it doesn't go anywhere.
Okay.
It stays right there.
Okay.
But I thought that if anyone ever tried to reach in and do something to me legally in Arizona, you can use deadly force on them. But I'd rather not. And that way I've got an implement I could use to shove somebody away from me without killing them. And I've thought about it. You know, you look at defensive situations where people are placed in a really bad spot where they're seatbelted in, they can't move, and they're in traffic and they can't get away. What are you going to do? And you better have thought of something to do. Cause like you say, when it hits the fan, you're not going to be able to think. You're just going to react.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And we keep in all our vehicles the emergency escape hammers with the blade on them to cut yourself free. And then, of course, everybody in my family, my daughters should be a black belt by May. My son and I are second degrees. We have lots of training, hand-wise pressure points, how to break people's fingers really easily, and, you know, what are the best angles.
Yeah, that takes the fight out of them real quick.
Oh, yeah. What was that? Oh, that was my tiki.
Yep. Whoopsie. One thing that I have on all my cars is the only thing that's on the key ring is a combination. It's a plastic. It's very lightweight. It's a combination glass cutter and seatbelt cutter, or glass punch and seatbelt cutter.
Yes.
And they're plastic. You get them on the internet for about $7 a piece. But every one of my keychains, I have three vehicles, every one of them has that on the keychain.
Good deal. Well, Mr. Eller, this has been quite an entertaining and enlightening conversation. And, you know, it's nice to talk to somebody who has a lot of the same beliefs and feelings. You know, in mental health, we tend to be, preparation. And then we start talking about physical stuff and something snaps in my profession, in my industry, where they, oh no, we can't do that. We can't do this. We can't do that. And I think we're not treating the whole patient if we're not looking at all aspects of their life. And I appreciate you coming on my show and talking about it.
My pleasure. In firearms training, we have a term for that. People who talk about it but don't do it, we call it cognitive dissonance.
Yes. Exactly. We have that term in psychology, too.
Yeah,
thank you very
amazing
much.
How that works. Enjoy.
Thank you. Well, that concludes our show today. I appreciate everybody listening. Thank you very much for checking us out. You can find out more about us at mainstreammentalhealth.org. And please tell your friends about our show. Listen to us on Blog Talk Radio. We also have our YouTube channel, Mainstream Mental Health. And remember, life is what happens while you're making plans. So buckle up.
Thanks for listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber. Check us out on social media, Google+, Mainstream Mental Health, Instagram at Mainstream Mental Health, Twitter at Mainstream MENTL, and search for Mainstream Mental Health on Facebook. Please tune in every week to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber.
The season of free is in full swing at T-Mobile. And this time, we're going big, like the biggest screen you'll ever see at T-Mobile big. Because we're giving away 50-inch Samsung 4K TVs. You heard right, a free 50-inch TV delivered in time for the holidays when you get one of the latest Samsung phones and add a line. So get to a T-Mobile store right now, because this deal won't last long.
At participating stores, offer fulfilled by Samsung with online redemption code. Qualifying credit, new line of service, timely redemption, and phone finance agreement required. 2 new lines required for new customers. 1 offer per account.
The season of free is in full swing at T-Mobile. And this time, we're going big, like the biggest screen you'll ever see at T-Mobile big. Because we're giving away 50-inch Samsung 4K TVs. You heard right, a free 50-inch TV delivered in time for the holidays when you get one of the latest Samsung phones and add a line. So get to a T-Mobile store right now, because this deal won't last long.
At participating stores, offer fulfilled by Samsung with online redemption code. Qualifying credit, new line of service, timely redemption, and phone finance agreement required. 2 new lines required for new customers. 1 offer per account.